The broken boy, Brandon of House Stark, prince of a lost kingdom, lord of a burned castle, heir to ruins. He had thought the three-eyed crow would be a sorcerer, a wise old wizard who could fix his legs. But that was some stupid child's dream, he realized now.
"I am too old for such fancies," he told himself. "A thousand eyes, 100 skins, wisdom deep as the roots of ancient trees."
That was as good as being a knight.
Almost as good, anyway.
The moon was a black hole in the sky. Outside the cave, the world went on. Outside the cave, the sun rose and set. The moon turned. The cold winds howled. Onto the hill, Jojen Reed grew even more sullen and solitary, to his sister's distress. She would often sit with Bran beside their little fire, talking of everything and nothing, petting Summer, where he slept between them, whilst her brother wandered the caverns by himself. Jojen had even taken to climbing up to the cave's mouth when the day was bright. He would stand there for hours, looking out over the forest, wrapped in furs, yet shivering all the same.
"He wants to go home," Mira told Bran. "He will not even try and fight his fate. He says the green dreams do not lay." "He's being brave," said Bran. "The only time a man can be brave is when he is afraid,"
his father had told him once, long ago, on the day they found the dire wolf pups in the summer snows. He still remembered.
"He's being stupid," Mira said. "I'd hoped that when we found your three-eyed crow. Now I wonder why we ever came." "For me," Bran thought. "His green dreams," he said. "His green dreams," Mira's voice was bitter.
"Hodor," said Hodor.
Mira began to cry. Bran hated being crippled then.
"Don't cry," he said.
He wanted to put his arms around her, hold her tight, the way his mother used to hold him back at Winterfell when he'd hurt himself. She was right there, only a few feet from him, but so far out of reach it might have been 100 leagues. To touch her, he would need to pull himself along the ground with his hands, dragging his legs behind him. The floor was rough and uneven, and it would be slow going, full of scrapes and bumps.
"I could put on Hodor's skin," he thought. "Hodor could hold her and pat her on the back."
The thought made Bran feel strange, but he was still thinking it when Mira bolted from the fire back into the darkness of the tunnels. He heard her steps recede, until there was nothing but the voices of the singers. The moon was a crescent, thin and sharp as a blade of a knife. The days marched past, one after the other, each shorter than the one before. The nights grew longer. No sunlight reached the caves beneath the hill. No moonlight ever touched its stony halls. Even the stars were strangers there. Those things belonged to the world above, where time ran in its iron circles, day to night, today to night, today.
"It is time," Lord Brynden said. Something in his voice sent icy fingers running up Bran's back. "Time for what?" "For the next step. For you to go beyond skin-changing and learn what it means to be a green seer." "The trees will teach him," said Leif.
She beckoned, and another of the singers padded forward, the white-haired one that Mira had named Snowy Locks. She had a weirwood bowl in her hands, carved with a dozen faces, like the ones the heart trees wore. Inside was a white paste, thick and heavy, with dark red veins running through it.
"You must eat of this," said Leif.
She handed Bran a wooden spoon. The boy looked at the bowl uncertainly.
"What is it?" "A paste of weirwood seeds."
Something about the look of it made Bran feel ill. The red veins were only weirwood sap, he supposed, but in the torchlight they looked remarkably like blood. He dipped the spoon into the paste, then hesitated.
"Will this make me a green seer?"
"Your blood makes you a green seer," said Lord Brynden.
"This will help awaken your gifts and wed you to the trees."
Brad did not want to be married to a tree, but who else would wed a broken boy like him?
1,000 eyes, 100 skins, wisdom deep as the roots of ancient trees, a green seer.
He ate. It had a bitter taste, though not so bitter as acorn paste. The first spoonful was the hardest to get down. He almost retched it right back up. The second tasted better. The third was almost sweet. The rest he spooned up eagerly. Why had he thought that it was bitter? It tasted of honey, of new-fallen snow, of pepper and cinnamon, and the last kiss his mother ever gave him. The empty bowl slipped from his fingers and clattered on the cavern floor.
"I don't feel any different. What happens next?"
Leif touched his hand.
"The trees will teach you. The trees remember."
She raised a hand, and the other singers began to move about the cavern, extinguishing the torches one by one. The darkness thickened and crept towards them.
"Close your eyes," said the three-eyed crow. "Slip your skin, as you do when you join with summer. But this time, go into the roots instead. Follow them up through the earth, to the trees upon the hill, and tell me what you see."
Bran closed his eyes and slipped free of his skin.
"Into the roots," he thought, "into the weirwood, become the tree."
For an instant he could see the cavern in its black mantle, could hear the river rushing by below. Then all at once he was back home again. Lord Eddard Stark sat upon a rock beside the deep black pool in the Guardswood, the pale roots of the heart tree twisting around him like an old man's gnarled arms. The great sword Ice lay across Lord Eddard's lap, and he was cleaning the blade with an oilcloth.
"Winterfell,"
Bran whispered. His father looked up. "Who's there?" he asked, turning. And Bran, frightened, pulled away. His father and the black pool and Guardswood faded and were gone, and he was back in the cavern, the pale, thick roots of his weirwood throne cradling his limbs as a mother does a child. A torch flared to life before him.
"Tell us what you saw."
From far away, Leif looked almost like a girl. No older than Bran, or one of his sisters, but close at hand, she seemed far older. She claimed to have seen 200 years. Bran's throat was very dry. He swallowed.
"Winterfell. I was back in Winterfell. I saw my father. He's not dead. He's not. I saw him. He's back at Winterfell. He's still alive."
"No," said Leif. "He's gone, boy. Do not seek to call him back from death."
"I saw him."
Bran could feel rough wood pressing against one cheek.
"He was cleaning ice." "You saw what you wished to see. Your heart yearns for your father and your home. So that is what you saw. A man must know how to look before he can hope to see," said Lord Brynden. "Those were shadows of days past that you saw, Bran. You were looking through the eyes of the heart tree in your Guardswood. Time is different for a tree than for a man. Sun and soil and water, these are the things a weirwood understands, not days and years and centuries. For men, time is a river. We are trapped in its flow, hurtling from past to present, always in the same direction. The lives of trees are different. They root and grow and die in one place, and that river does not move them. The oak is the acorn is the oak, and the weirwood, 1,000 human years, are a moment to a weirwood. and through such gates you and I may gaze into the past.
But, said Bran, he heard me.
He heard a whisper on the wind, a rustling amongst the leaves. He cannot speak to him, try as you might, I know. I have my own ghost, Bran, a brother that I loved, a brother that I hated, a woman I desired. Through the trees I see them still, but no word of mine has ever reached them. The past remains the past. We can learn from it, but we cannot change it. Will I see my father again? Once you have mastered your gifts, you may look where you will and see what the trees have seen. Be it yesterday or last year or 1,000 ages past, men live their lives trapped in an eternal present, between the mists of memory and the sea of shadow. That is all we know of the days to come. Certain moths live their whole lives in a day, yet to them that little span of time must seem as long as years and decades do to us. An oak may live 300 years, a redwood tree 3,000. A weirwood will live forever, if left undisturbed. To them seasons pass in the flutter of a moth's wing, and past, present, and future are one. Nor will your sight be limited to your god's wood. The singers carved eyes into their heart trees to awaken them, and those are the first eyes a new green seer learns to use. But in time you will see well beyond the trees themselves.
When? Bran wanted to know.
In a year, or 3, or 10. That I have not glimpsed. It will come in time, I promise you. But I am tired now, and the trees are calling me. We will resume on the morrow.
Hodor carried Bran back to his chamber, muttering, Hodor! In a low voice, as Leif went before them with a torch. He had hoped that Mira and Jojen would be there, so he could tell them what he had seen. But their snug alcove in the rock was cold and empty. Hodor eased Bran down onto his bed, covered him with furs, and made a fire for them.
1,000 eyes, 100 skins. Wisdom deep has the roots of ancient trees.
Watching the flames, Bran decided he would stay awake till Mira came back. Jojen would be unhappy, he knew, but Mira would be glad for him. He did not remember closing his eyes. But then, somehow he was back at Winterfell again, in the guard's wood, looking down upon his father. Lord Eddard seemed much younger this time. His hair was brown, with no hint of grey in it. His head bowed. Let them grow up, close as brothers, with only love between them, he prayed. And let my lady wife find it in her heart to forgive.
Father!
Bran's voice was a whisper in the wind, a rustle in the leaves.
Father, it's me. It's Bran. Brandon.
Eddard Stark lifted his head and looked long at the weirwood, frowning, but he did not speak.
He cannot see me,
Bran realized, despairing. He wanted to reach out and touch him, but all he could do was watch and listen.
I am in the tree. I am inside the art tree, looking out of its red eyes, but the weirwood cannot talk, so I can't.
Eddard Stark resumed his prayer. Bran felt his eyes fill up with tears, but were they his own tears or the weirwood's?
If I cry, will the tree begin to weep?
The rest of his father's words were drowned out by a sudden clatter of wood on wood. Eddard Stark dissolved, like mist in a morning sun. Now 2 children danced across the god's wood, hooting at one another as they duelled with broken branches. The girl was the older and taller of the 2.
Harrier,
Bran thought eagerly, as he watched her leap onto a rock and cut at the boy. But that couldn't be right. If the girl was Arya, the boy was Bran himself, and he had never worn his hair so long.
And Arya never beat me, playing swords, the way that girl has beaten him.
She slashed the boy across his thigh, so hard that his leg went out from under him, and he fell into the pool and began to splash and shout.
"You be quiet, stupid," the girl said, tossing her own branch aside. "It's just water. Do you want old Nan to hear and run tell father?"
She knelt and pulled her brother from the pool. But before she got him out again, the two of them were gone. After that, the glimpses came faster and faster, till Bran was feeling lost and dizzy. He saw no more of his father, nor the girl who looked like Arya. But a woman, heavy with child, emerged naked and dripping from the black pool, knelt before the tree, and begged the old gods for a son who would avenge her. Then there came a brown-haired girl, slender as a spear, who stood on the tips of her toes to kiss the lips of a young knight as tall as Hodor. A dark-eyed youth, pale and fierce, sliced three branches off the weirwood and shaped them into arrows. The tree itself was shrinking, growing smaller with each vision, whilst the lesser trees dwindled into saplings and vanished, only to be replaced by other trees that would dwindle and vanish in their turn. And now the lords Bran glimpsed were tall and hard, stern men in fur and chainmail. Some wore faces he remembered from the statues in the crypts, but they were gone before he could put a name to them. Then, as he watched, a bearded man forced a captive down onto his knees before the heart tree. A white-haired woman stepped toward them through a drift of dark red leaves, a bronze sickle in her hand.
"No," said Bran, "no, don't."
But they could not hear him, no more than his father had. The woman grabbed the captive by the hair, hooked the sickle round his throat, and slashed. And through the mist of centuries, the broken boy could only watch as a man's feet drummed against the earth. But as his life flowed out of him in a red tide, Brandon Stark could taste the blood. John. The sun had broken through near midday, after 7 days of dark skies and snow flurries. Some of the drifts were higher than a man, but the stewards had been shoveling all day, and the paths were as clean as they were like to get. Reflections glimmered off the wall, every crack and crevice glittering pale blue. 700 feet up, John Snow stood looking down upon the haunted forest. A north wind swirled through the trees below, sending thin white plumes of snow crystals flying from the highest branches, like icy banners. Elsewise, nothing moved. Not a sign of life. That was not entirely reassuring. It was not the living that he feared. Even so, the sun is out. The snow has stopped. It may be a moon's turn before we have another chance as good. It may be a season. "Have Emmett assemble his recruits," he told Dolorous Ed. "We'll want an escort. 10 rangers, armed with dragon glass. I want them ready to leave within the hour."
"Aye, my lord. And to command?"
"That would be me." Ed's mouth turned on even more than usual.
"Some might think it better if the Lord Commander stayed safe and warm south of the wall. Not that I'd say such myself, but some might."
John smiled. "Some had best not say so in my presence." A sudden gust of wind set Ed's cloak to flapping noisily.
"Best to go down, my lord. This wind's like to push us off the wall, and I never did learn the knack of flying."
They rode the winch lift back to the ground. The wind was gusting, cold as the breath of the ice dragon in the tales old Nan had told them when John was a boy. The heavy cage was swaying. From time to time, it scraped against the wall, starting small crystalline showers of ice that sparkled in the sunlight as they fell, like shards of broken glass. "Glass," John mused, "might be of use here. Castle Black needs its own glass gardens, like the ones at Winterfell. We could grow vegetables even in the deep of winter." The best glass came from Mir, but a good clear pane was worth its weight in spice, and green and yellow glass would not work as well.
What we need is gold. With enough coin we could buy prentice glass blowers and glaziers in Mir, bring them north, offer them their freedom for teaching their art to some of our recruits. That would be the way to go about it.
If we had the gold, which we do not. At the base of the wall he found Ghost, rolling in a snowbank. The big white direwolf seemed to love fresh snow. When he saw John, he bounded back onto his feet and shook himself off. Dolores Ed said,
"He's going with you, eh?"
"He is."
"Oh, a clever wolf, him. And me?"
"You're not."
"A clever lord, you. Ghost's the better choice. I don't have the teeth for biting wildlings any more."
"If the guards are good, we won't encounter any wildlings. I'll want the grey gelding." Word spread fast at Castle Black. Ed was still saddling the grey when Bowen Marsh stumped across the yard to confront John at the stables.
"My lord, I wish you would reconsider. The new men can take their vows in the sept as easily."
"The sept is home to the new gods. The old gods live in the wood, and those who honour them say their words amongst the weirwoods. You know that as well as I."
"Saturn comes from Oldtown, and Aaron and Emric from the Westerlands. The old gods are not their gods."
"I do not tell men which god to worship. They were free to choose the Seven, or the Red Woman's Lord of Light. They chose the trees instead, with all the peril that entails."
"The Weeping Man may still be out there watching."
"The grove is no more than 2 hours' ride, even with the snow. We should be back by midnight."
"Too long. This is not wise."
"Unwise," said John, "but necessary. These men are about to pledge their lives to the Night's Watch, joining a brotherhood that stretches back in an unbroken line for thousands of years. The words matter, and so do these traditions. They bind us all together, high-born and low, young and old, base and noble. They make us brothers." He clapped Marsh on his shoulder. "I promise you, we shall return."
"Aye, my lord," said the Lord Steward. "But will it be as living men, or heads on spears, with your eyes scooped out? You will be returning through the black of night. The snowdrifts are waist-deep in places. I see that you're taking seasoned men with you. Well, that is good. But Black Jack Bulwer knew these woods as well. Even Benjen Stark, your own uncle, he—"
"I have something they did not." John turned his head and whistled. "Ghost, to me." The direwolf shook the snow from his back and trotted to John's side. The rangers parted to let him through, though one mare whinnied and shied away until Rory gave her reins a sharp tug. "The wall is yours, Lord Bowen." He took his horse by the bridle and walked him to the gate and the icy tunnel that snaked beneath the wall. Beyond the ice, the trees stood tall and silent, huddled in thick white cloaks. Ghost stalked beside John's horse as the rangers and recruits formed up, then stopped and sniffed, his breath frosting in the air. "What is it?" John asked. "Is someone there?" The woods were empty as far as he could see, but that was not very far. Ghost bounded toward the trees, slipped between two white-cloaked pines, and vanished in a cloud of snow. "He wants to hunt. But what?" John did not fear for the direwolf so much as for any wildlings he might encounter. A white wolf in a white wood, silent as a shadow. They will never know his coming. He knew better than to go chasing him. Ghost would return when he wanted to, and not before. John put his heels into his horse. His men fell in around them, the hooves of their garrons breaking through the icy crust to the softer snow beneath. Into the woods they went, at a steady walking pace, as the wall dwindled behind them.
The soldier pines and sentinels wore thick white coats, and icicles draped the bare brown limbs of the broadleafs. John sent Tom Barleycorn ahead to scout for them, though the way to the White Grove was off-trod and familiar. Big Liddle and Luke of Longtown slipped into the brush to east and west. They would flank the column to give warning of any approach. All were seasoned rangers, armed with obsidian as well as steel, war horns slung across their saddles should they need to summon help. The others were good men, too. Good men in a fight, at least, and loyal to their brothers. John could not speak for what they might have been before they reached the wall, but he did not doubt that most had pasts as black as their cloaks. Up here they were the sort of men he wanted at his back. Their hoods were raised against the biting wind, and some had scarves wrapped about their faces, hiding their features. John knew them, though. Every name was graven on his heart. They were his men, his brothers. Six more rode with them, a mix of young and old, large and small, seasoned and raw. Six to say the words. Horse had been born and raised in Molestown. Aaron and Emmerich came from Fair Isle, Satin from the brothels of Oldtown at the other end of Westeros. All of them were boys. Leathers and Jacks were older men, well past 40, sons of the Haunted Forest, with sons and grandsons of their own. They had been two of the 63 wildlings who had followed Jon Snow back to the wall the day he made his appeal. So far, the only two to decide they wanted a black cloak. Iron Emmett said they all were ready, or as ready as they were ever going to be. He and John and Bowen Marsh had weighed each man in turn and assigned them to an order. Leathers, Jacks, and Emmerich to the rangers, Horse to the builders, Aaron and Satin to the stewards. The time had come for them to take their vows. Iron Emmett rode at the head of the column, mounted on the ugliest horse John had ever seen, a shaggy beast that looked to be all hair and hooves. "Talk is there was some trouble at Harlot's Tower last night," the master at arms said. "Harden's Tower?" Of the 63 who had come back with him from Molestown, 19 had been women and girls. John had housed them in the same abandoned tower where he had once slept when he had been new to the wall. 12 were spear wives, more than capable of defending both themselves and the younger girls from the unwanted attentions of black brothers. It was some of the men they turned away who had given Harden's Tower its new inflammatory name. John was not about to condone the mockery. 3 drunken fools mistook Harden's for a brothel, that's all. They are in the ice cells now, contemplating their mistake. Iron Emmett grimaced. "Men are men, vows are words, and words are wind. You should put guards around the women." "And who will guard the guards?"
"You know nothing, Jon Snow."
He had learned, though, and Ygritte had been his teacher. If he could not hold to his own vows, how could he expect more of his brothers? But there were dangers in trifling with wilding women.
"A man can own a woman, and a man can own a knife,"
Ygritte had told him once,
"but no man can own both."
Bowen Marsh had not been all wrong. Harden's Tower was tinder waiting for a spark. "I mean to open 3 more castles," John said, "Deep Lake, Sable Hall, and the Long Barrow, all garrisoned with free folk, under the command of our own officers. The Long Barrow would be all women, aside from the commander and chief steward. Oh, there would be some mingling, he did not doubt, but the distances were great enough to make that difficult, at least. And what poor fool will get that choice command? I am riding beside him." The look of mingled horror and delight that passed across Iron Emmett's face was worth more than a sack of gold. "What have I done to make you hate me so, my lord?" John laughed. "Have no fear, you won't be alone. I mean to give you Dolorous Ed as your second and your steward.
The Spearwise will be so happy. You might do well to bestow a castle on the Magna.
John Smile died. I might, if I could trust him.
Sigorn blames me for his father's death, I fear. Worse, he was bred and trained to give orders, not to take them.
Do not confuse their thens with free folk.
Magna means lord in the old tongue, I am told, but Styr was closer to a god to his people, and his son is cut from the same skin. I do not require men to kneel, but they do need to obey.
I am a lord, but you had best do something with the Magna. You'll have trouble with the thens if you ignore them.
Trouble is the Lord Commander's lot, John might have said. His visit to Molestown was giving him plenty, as it happened, and the women were the least of it. Halleck was proving to be just as truculent as he had feared, and there were some amongst the Black Brothers whose hatred of the free folk was bone deep. One of Halleck's followers had already cut off a builder's ear in the yard, and like as not that was just a taste of the bloodshed to come. He had to get the old forts open soon, so Harmer's brother could be sent off to garrison Deep Lake or Sable Hall. Just now, though, neither of those was fit for human habitation, and Othel Yarvik and his builders were still off trying to restore the night fort. There were nights when Jon Snow wondered if he had not made a grievous mistake by preventing Stannis from marching all the wildlings off to be slaughtered.
"I know nothing, Ygritte," he thought, "and perhaps I never will." Half a mile from the grove, long red shafts of autumn sunlight were slanting down between the branches of the leafless trees, staining the snowdrifts pink. The riders crossed a frozen stream between two jagged rocks armoured in ice, then followed a twisting game trail to the northeast. Whenever the wind kicked up, sprays of loose snow filled the air and stung their eyes. John pulled his scarf up over his mouth and nose and raised the hood on his cloak.
"Not far now," he told the men.
No one replied.
John smelled Tom Barleycorn before he saw him.
Or was it Ghost who smelled him? Of late, Jon Snow sometimes felt as if he and the direwolf were one, even awake. The great white wolf appeared first, shaking off the snow. A few moments later, Tom was there.
"Wildlings," he told Jon softly, "in the grove."
Jon brought the riders to a halt.
"How many?"
"I counted 9. No guards. Some dead might be, or sleeping. Most look to be women. One child, but there's a giant, too, just the one that I saw. They've got a fire burning, smoke drifting through the trees. Fools!"
9, and I have 7 and 10. 4 of his were green boys, though, and none were giants.
John was not of a mind to fall back to the wall, however. "If the wildlings are still alive, it may be we can bring them in. And if they are dead, well, a corpse or two could be of use." "We'll continue on foot," he said, dropping lightly to the frozen ground. The snow was ankle-deep. "Rory, Pate, stay with the horses." He might have given that duty to the recruits, but they would need to be blooded soon enough. Well, this was as good a time as any. "Spread out and form a crescent. I want to close in on the grove from 3 sides. Keep the men to your right and left in sight, so the gaps do not widen. The snow should muffle our steps. Less chance of blood if we take them unawares." Night was falling fast. The shafts of sunlight had vanished when the last thin slice of the sun was swallowed beneath the western woods. The pink snowdrifts were going white again, the colour leaching out of them as the world darkened. The evening sky had turned the faded grey of an old cloak that had been washed too many times, and the first shy stars were coming out. Ahead he glimpsed a pale white trunk that could only be a weirwood, crowned with a head of dark red leaves. Jon Snow reached back and pulled Longclaw from his sheath.
He looked to right and left, gave Saturn and Horse a nod, watched them pass it on to the men beyond. They rushed the grove together, kicking through drifts of old snow with no sound but their breathing. Ghost ran with them, a white shadow at John's side. The weirwoods rose in a circle around the edges of the clearing. There were nine, all roughly of the same age and size. Each one had a face carved into it, and no two faces were alike. Some were smiling, some were screaming, some were shouting at him. In the deepening glow, their eyes looked black, but in daylight they would be blood-red, John knew. Eyes like ghosts. The fire in the center of the grove was a small, sad thing. Ashes and embers, and a few broken branches burning slow and smoky. Even then it had more life than the wildlings huddled near it. Only one of them reacted when John stepped from the brush. That was the child, who began to wail, clutching at his mother's ragged cloak. The woman raised her eyes and gasped. By then the grove was ringed by rangers, sliding past the bone-white trees, steel glinting in black-gloved hands, poised for slaughter. The giant was the last to notice them. He had been asleep, curled up by the fire. But something woke him. The child's cry, the sound of snow crunching beneath black boots, a sudden indrawn breath. When he stirred, it was as if a boulder had come to life. He heaved himself into a sitting position with a snort, pawing at his eyes with hands as big as hams to rub the sleep away, until he saw Iron Emmett, his sword shining in his hand. Roaring, he came leaping to his feet, and one of those huge hands closed around a maul and jerked it up. Ghost showed his teeth in answer. John grabbed the wolf by the scruff of the neck. "We want no battle here." His men could bring the giant down, he knew, but not without cost. Once blood was shed, the wildlings would join the fray. Most or all would die here, and some of his own brothers, too. "This is a holy place. Yield, and we—" The giant bellowed again, a sound that shook the leaves and the trees, and slammed his maul against the ground. The shaft of it was 6 feet of gnarled oak, the head a stone as big as a loaf of bread. The impact made the ground shake. Some of the other wildlings went scrambling for their own weapons. John Snow was about to reach for Longclaw when Leather spoke from the far side of the grove. His words sounded gruff and guttural, but John heard the music in it and recognized the old tongue. Leather spoke for a long while. When he was done, the giant answered. It sounded like growling, interspersed with grunts, and John could not understand a word of it. But Leathers pointed at the trees and said something else, and the giant pointed at the trees, ground his teeth, and dropped his maul.
"It's done," said Leathers. "They want no fight."
"Well done, but what did you tell him?"
"That they were our gods, too. That we came to pray."
"We shall. Put away your steel, all of you. We will have no bloodshed here tonight." "Nine," Tom Barleycorn had said. And nine there were. But two were dead, and one so weak he might have died by morning. The six who remained included a mother and child, two old men, a wounded thin in battered bronze, and one of the Hornfoot folk, his bare feet so badly frostbitten that John knew at a glance he would never walk again. Most had been strangers to one another when they came to the grove, he learned, subsequently. When Stannis broke Mance Raider's host, they had fled into the woods to escape the carnage, wandered for a time, lost friends and kin to cold and starvation, and finally washed up here, too weak and weary to go on.
"The gods are here,"
one of the old men said.
"This was as good a place to die as any."
"The wall is only a few hours south of here," said John. "Why not seek shelter there? Others yielded, even Mance." The wildlings exchanged looks. Finally one said,
"'We heard stories. "'The crows burned all them that yielded.'
"'Even Mance himself,' the woman added.
"'Melisandre, John thought, "'you and your red god have much and more to answer for. "'All those who wish are welcome to return with us. "'There's food and shelter at Castle Black, "'and the wall to keep you safe from the things that haunt these woods. "'You have my word. No one will burn.'
"'A crow's word,'
the woman said, hugging her child close.
"'But who's to say that you can keep it? Who are you?'
"'Lord Commander of the Night's Watch, and the son of Eddard Stark, of Winterfell.' John turned to Tom Barleycorn. "'Have Rory and Fate bring up the horses. I do not mean to stay here one moment longer than we must.'
"'As you say, my lord.'
One last thing remained before they could depart. The thing they had come for. Arn Emmett called forth his charges, and as the rest of the company watched from a respectful distance, they knelt before the weirwoods. The last light of day was gone by then. The only light came from the stars above, and the faint red glow of the dying fire in the centre of the grove. With their black hoods and thick black cowls, the six might have been carved from shadow. Their voices rose together, small against the vastness of the night. "'Night gathers, and now my watch begins,' they said, as thousands had said before them. Saturn's voice was sweet as song. Horses, hoarse and halting. Errands, a nervous squeak. "'It shall not end until my death. May those deaths be long in coming.' John Snow sank to one knee in the snow. "'Gods of my fathers, protect these men, and Arya too, my little sister, wherever she might be. I pray you, let Mance find her, and bring her safe to me. I shall take no wife, hold no lands, father no children,' the recruits promised, in voices that echoed back through years and centuries. I shall wear no crowns and win no glory. I shall live and die at my post. "'Gods of the woods, grant me the strength to do the same,' Jon Snow prayed silently. "'Give me the wisdom to know what must be done, and the courage to do it.' "'I am the sword in the darkness,' said the six, and it seemed to Jon as though their voices were changing, growing stronger, more certain. I am the watcher on the walls. I am the fire that burns against the cold, the light that brings the dawn, the horn that wakes the sleepers, the shield that guards the realms of men. The shield that guards the realms of men? Ghost nuzzled up against his shoulder, and John draped an arm around him. He could smell horses' unwashed breeches, the sweet scent satin combed into his beard, the rank sharp smell of fear, the giant's overpowering musk. He could hear the beating of his own heart. When he looked across the grove, at the woman with her child, the two greybeards, the hornfoot man with his maned feet, all he saw was men. I pledge my life and honour to the Night's Watch for this night and all the nights to come. Jon Snow was the first unto his feet. Rise now, as men of the Night's Watch. He gave horse a hand to pull him up. The wind was rising. It was time to go. The journey back took much longer than the journey to the grove. The giant's pace was a ponderous one, despite the length and girth of those legs, and he was forever stopping to knock snow off low-hanging limbs with his maw. The woman rode double with Rory, her son with Tom Barleycorn, the old man with horse and satin. The Thin was frightened of the horses, however, and preferred to limp along despite his wounds. The hornfoot man could not sit a saddle, and had to be tied over the back of a garron like a sack of grain. So too the pale-faced crone, with his stick-thin limbs, whom they had not been able to rouse. They did the same with the two corpses, to the puzzlement of Arn Emmett. "'They will only slow us, my lord,' he said to John. "We should chop them up and burn them." "No," said John, "bring them. I have use for them." They had no moon to guide them home, and only now and then a patch of stars. The world was black and white and still. It was a long, slow, endless trek. The snow clung to their boots and breeches, and the wind rattled the pines and made their cloaks snap and swirl. John glimpsed the red wanderer above, watching them through the leafless branches of great trees as they made their way beneath. The thief, the free folk called it. The best time to steal a woman was when the thief was in the Moon Maid, Ygritte had always claimed. She never mentioned the best time to steal a giant or two dead men. It was almost dawn before they saw the wall again. A sentry's horn greeted them as they approached, sounding from on high like the cry of some huge, deep-throated bird, a single lung blast that meant "Rangers returning." Big Little unslung his own war horn and gave answer. At the gate they had to wait a few moments before Dolorous Ed Tollett appeared to slide back the bolts and swing open the iron bars. When Ed caught sight of the ragged band of wildlings, he pursed his lips and gave the giant a long look.
"Might need some butter to slide that one through the tunnel, my lord. Shall I send someone to the larder?"
"Oh, I think he'll fit. Unbuttered." So he did, on hands and knees, crawling. A big boy, this one, 14 feet at least, even bigger than Mag the Mighty. Mag had died beneath this very ice, locked in mortal struggle with Donal Noy. A good man. The Watch had lost too many good men. John took Leathers aside.
"Take charge of him. You speak his tongue. See that he is fed, and find him a warm place by the fire. Stay with him. See that no one provokes him."
"Aye," Leathers hesitated, "my lord." The living wildlings John sent off to have their wounds and frostbites tended. Some hot food and warm clothes would restore most of them, he hoped, though the horn-foot man was like to lose both feet. The corpses he consigned to the ice cells. Clydes had come and gone, John noted, as he was hanging his cloak on the peg beside the door. A letter had been left on the table in Isola. East Watch, or the Shadow Tower, he assumed at first glance. But the wax was gold, not black. The seal showed a stag's head within a flaming heart. "Stannis!" John cracked the hardened wax, flattened the roll of parchment, read, "A maester's hand, but the king's words." Stannis had taken Deepwood Mott, and the mountain clans had joined him, Flint, Norrie, Wall, Little, all. "And we had other help, unexpected but most welcome, from a daughter of Bear Island, Alisane Mormont, whose men name her the She-Bear, hid fighters inside a gaggle of fishing sloops, and took the Iron Men unawares where they lay off the strand. Greyjoy's longships are burned or taken, her crew slain or surrendered. The captains, knights, notable warriors, and others of high birth, we shall ransom or make other use of. The rest I mean to hang." The Night's Watch was sworn to take no side in the quarrels and conflicts of the realm. Nonetheless, Jon Snow could not help but feel a certain satisfaction. He read on, "More Northmen coming in as word spreads of our victory. Fisher folk, free riders, hillmen, crofters from the deep of the Wolf's Wood, and villagers who fled their homes along the stony shore to escape the Iron Men, survivors from the battle outside the gates of Winterfell, men once sworn to the Hornwoods, the Serwins, and the Tallhearts. We are 5,000 strong, as I write, our numbers swelling every day, and word has come to us that Roose Bolton moves toward Winterfell with all his power, there to wed his bastard to your half-sister.
He must not be allowed to restore the castle to its former strength. We march against him. Arn of Carstock and Mors Umber will join us. I will save your sister, if I can, and find a better match for her than Ramsay Snow. You and your brothers must hold the wall until I can return. It was signed in a different hand. Done in the light of Lord, under the sign and seal of Stannis of House Baratheon, the first of his name, King of the Andals, the Rhoynar, and the First Men, Lord of the Seven Kingdoms, and Protector of the Realm. The moment John set the letter aside, the parchment curled up again, as if eager to protect its secrets. He was not at all sure how he felt about what he had just read. Battles had been fought at Winterfell before, but never one without a Stark on one side or the other. "The castle is a shell," he said. "Not Winterfell, but the ghost of Winterfell." It was painful just to think of it, much less say the words aloud. And still, he wondered how many men old Crowfood would bring to the fray, and how many swords Arn of Carstock would be able to conjure up. Half the Umbers would be across the field with Horsebane, fighting beneath the flayed man of the Dreadfort, and the greater part of the strength of both houses had gone south with Rob, never to return. Even ruined, Winterfell itself would confer a considerable advantage on whoever held it. Robert Baratheon would have seen that at once and moved swiftly to secure the castle, with the forced marches and midnight rides for which he had been famous. Would his brother be as bold? Not likely. Stannis was a deliberate commander, and his host was a half-digested stew of clansmen, Southron knights, kingsmen and queensmen, salted with a few northern lords. He should move on Winterfell swiftly or not at all, John thought. It was not his place to advise the king, but he glanced at the letter again. "I will save your sister if I can." Surprisingly tender sentiment from Stannis, though undercut by that final brutal "if I can," and the addendum "and find a better match for her than Ramsay Snow." But what if Arya was not there to be saved? What if Lady Melisandre's flames had told it true? Could his sister truly have escaped such captors? How would she do that? Arya was always quick and clever, but in the end she's just a little girl, and Roose Bolton is not the sort who would be careless for the prize of such great worth. What if Bolton never had his sister? This wedding could well be just some ruse to lure Stannis into a trap. Eddard Stark had never had any reason to complain of the Lord of the Dreadfort, so far as John knew. But even so, he had never trusted him, with his whispery voice and his pale, pale eyes. A grey girl on a dying horse, fleeing from her marriage. On the strength of those words, he had loose Mance Rayder and 6 spear wives on the north.
"Young ones, and pretty," Mance had said.
The unburnt king supplied some names, and Dolorous Ed had done the rest, smuggling them from Molestown. It seemed like madness now. He might have done better to strike down Mance the moment he revealed himself. John had a certain grudging admiration for the late king beyond the wall, but the man was an oath-breaker and a turncloak. He had even less trust in Melisandre. Yet somehow here he was, pinning his hopes on them. "All to save my sister. But the men of the Night's Watch have no sisters." When John had been a boy at Winterfell, his hero had been the young dragon, the boy king who had conquered Dorne at the age of 14. Despite his bastard birth, or perhaps because of it, Jon Snow had dreamed of leading men to glory, just as King Daeron had, of growing up to be a conqueror. Now he was a man grown, and the wall was his. yet all he had were doubts. He could not even seem to conquer those.
Daenerys. The stench of the camp was so appalling, it was all that Danny could do not to gag. Sebastian wrinkled up his nose and said, "Your Grace should not be here, breathing these black humours."
"I am the blood of the dragon," Danny reminded him. "Have you ever seen a dragon with a flux?"
Viserys had oft claimed that Targaryens were untroubled by the pestilences that afflicted common men, and so far she could tell, it was true. She could remember being cold and hungry and afraid, but never sick.
"Even so," the old knight said, "I would feel better if your grace would return to the city."
The many-coloured brick walls of Meereen were half a mile back.
"The bloody flux has been the bane of every army since the Dawn Age. Let us distribute the food, your grace." "On the morrow. I am here now. I want to see."
She put her heels into her silver. The others trotted after her. Jogo rode before her, Aggo and Ricaro just behind, long Dothraki whips in hand to keep away the sick and dying. Sir Barristan was at her right, mounted on a dapple grey. To her left was Simon Stripeback, of the Free Brothers, and Marcellin of the Mother's Men. 60 soldiers followed close behind the captains, to protect the food wagons. Mounted men all, Dothraki, and brazen beasts and freedmen. They were united only by their distaste for this duty. The Astapori stumbled after them in a ghastly procession that grew longer with every yard they crossed. Some spoke tongues she did not understand. Others were beyond speaking. Many lifted their hands to Danny, or knelt as her silver went by. "Mother!" they called to her, in the dialects of Astapor, Lice, and Old Volantis, in guttural Dothraki, and the liquid syllables of Kaas, even in the common tongue of Westeros.
"Mother, please, mother, help my sister. She is sick. Give me food for my little ones, please. My old father, help him, help her, help me."
"I have no more help to give," Danny thought, despairing.
The Astapori had no place to go. Thousands remained outside Meereen's thick walls, men and women and children, old men and little girls and newborn babes. Many were sick, most were starved, and all were doomed to die. Daenerys dared not open her gates to let them in. She had tried to do what she could for them. She had sent them healers, blue graces, spell singers, and barber surgeons. But some of those had sickened as well, and none of their arts had slowed the galloping progression of the flux that had come on the pale mare. Separating the healthy from the sick had proved impractical as well. Her stalwart shields had tried, pulling husbands away from wives and children from their mothers, even as the Astapori wept and kicked and pelted them with stones. A few days later, the sick were dead, and the healthy ones were sick. Dividing the one from the other had accomplished nothing. Even feeding them had grown difficult. Every day she sent them what she could, but every day there were more of them, and less food to give them. It was growing harder to find drivers willing to deliver the food as well. Too many of the men they had sent into the camp had been stricken by the flux themselves. Others had been attacked on the way back to the city. Yesterday a wagon had been overturned and two of her soldiers killed, so today the Queen had determined that she would bring the food herself. Every one of her advisers had argued fervently against it, from Raznak and the Shavepate to Sir Barristan, but Daenerys would not be moved.
"I will not turn away from them," she said stubbornly. "A queen must know the sufferings of her people."
Suffering was the only thing they did not lack.
"There is scarcely a horse or mule left, though many rode from Astapor," Marcellin reported to her. "They've eaten every one, your grace, along with every rat and scavenger dog they could catch. Now some have begun to eat their own dead."
"'Man must not eat the flesh of man,' said Argo.
"'It is known,' agreed Ricaro. "'They will be cursed.'
"'They're past cursing,' said Simon.